In June 1381, London experienced what one historian I read described as the three most exciting days of its medieval history. That phrase has always stuck in my mind. From our point of view, they were exciting days indeed. I mean, looking back over the gulf of history, they appear as incredible events steeped in danger and excitement. A teenage boy facing down a massive mob of violent rioters. A city ravaged by explosions and massacres. But for the people at the time who were there, these were terrifying days. Unprecedented in their suddenness and ferocity. Days of darkness and nights of fear. And more than that, they were a few days where the political passions of London, which we have covered in detail over the last few episodes, ran headlong into the political passions of the rest of the country. And the result was a city bathed in blood and carnage. Which begs the question, where the hell did all this come from? This violence did not begin in London. It began out to the east, in Essex. In Kent. Regular listeners may remember, back in the earlier episodes, London's relationship to Kent and Essex had been crucial to the story of the city. Wars had been fought between the London Sinn and the residents of Essex. Kent had seen numerous battlefields where Londoners were involved. Rochester in particular has appeared countless times in this podcast. But by the 14th century, times had changed. Essex and Kent were no longer places associated with warfare and the city of London. And yet here and now, out of seeming nowhere, this forgotten path of London's history suddenly becomes important again. So why did the men of these regions rise up and why did they come to London? This then is the purpose of this chapter, to examine the causes of what was to become known as the Peasants' Revolt. Hi, my name is Saul, and you are listening to The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the chronological history of the City of London in regular weekly chunks. Each episode is designed to stand alone. I don't know if it always succeeds, but we do try. And taken together, they produce an immense saga as we drag our weary way through the ages of history. This episode, as we said, is mostly focused on the principal causes of the Peasants' Revolt, and I'd like to welcome you to the 132nd chapter of this story of London, or we will help ourselves. When King Edward III of England, that elderly and somewhat bewildered monarch, finally passed from this earth, he was replaced by the son of his son, 10-year-old Prince Richard, now designated King Richard II. The young boy king inherited many of his grandfather's policies and was in no position to change things given his age. One such inheritance was the crippling war with France, which was bankrupting the nation. And we were losing. But another element he'd inherited had been his grandfather's labour laws. Long-term listeners may remember when I mentioned the Statute of Labourers, which King Edward III had pushed through Parliament and placed upon this land. This law ignored the shortage in the labour market caused by the bubonic plague. It forbade the survivors of that terrible pandemic from dictating higher prices for their services because of a shortage of manpower. It forced people to remain working on the land that they had worked at traditionally for the same wages. Now, within the whirling hustle and bustle of the City of London, the effects of this law had been quickly integrated into the ongoing maelstrom of the city's economy. But out in the countryside, the effects of this were still being heavily felt. Men were obligated, by law and the full weight of the state, to demand wages that matched those only of a long past era of the land before the plague. There had been four significant outbreaks of the disease that had ravaged the land since then, and yet still, the statute of labourers was still enforced. And this had caused a never-ending sense of grievance and disobedience across the land. And perhaps this had caused the seeds of something darker. Soon after the young king took the throne, a petition was presented to Parliament, which alleged that rural workers across England were responding to this ongoing situation in very ominous ways. Quote, "These men have refused to allow the officials of the Lords to distrain them for said customs and services, and have made confederation and alliance together to resist lords and their officials by force, so that each will aid the other whenever they are distrained for any reason. And they threaten to kill their lord's servants if these make distraint upon them for their customs and their services. The consequence is that, for fear of the deaths that might result from the rebellion and resistance of these men, their lords and their officials do not make distraint for their customs and their services." Unquote. This was not a green and pleasant land of ye olde happy rural folk. This was a febrile and dangerous place of workers feeling exploited and fomenting conspiracy and rebellion. As I've said before quite a few times, often rebellion can be seen as a parched wilderness awaiting a spark to ignite it. But to labour that particular metaphor, now allow me say that someone was just about to cover this dried earth with petrol, because it is now that someone decides to introduce a religious element to all these feelings. This religiosity was unwittingly caused by the teachings of the Oxford scholar and theologian John Wycliffe. In a brutally brief and not actually doing the subject justice summary, Wycliffe was focused on church reform. From around 1377, John Wycliffe called for the church to give up its property and live in evangelical poverty, surviving on the charity of the faithful. But then he went beyond that. He questioned the power of the Pope to be able to excommunicate anyone, and it was reported by his peers, quote, that neither the king nor any secular lord could give property in perpetuity to any person or church, because if such should habitually commit sin, temporal lords might meritoriously take away from them what they had been previously given, which, he said, was practiced in the time of William Rufus. He asserted, moreover, that if they stood in need, temporal lords might lawfully lay claim to the goods of possessions to relieve their want, unquote. So yeah, Wycliffe basically insisting that priests should live in, as it said, evangelical poverty, that the bishops and the abbots shouldn't own the lands they had owned since, in some cases, Saxon times. Temporal lords should be able to just claim them back. Now, this kind of theory was awesome for the likes of the king's son, John of Gaunt. And he adored it because it simply allowed secular lords power over the church lords. Hence why he ended up becoming a patron of John Wycliffe. But away from this, John Wycliffe was said to have been responsible for the sending out of charismatic preachers who agreed with his theology, and these were called the poor priests. They quickly developed a bevy of nicknames such as the babblers and the lollards. Elements of the lollards apparently, almost inevitably, took his ideas further than he intended and supposedly denounced the landowners, secular as well as landowning churchmen. Alarmed by the words of this extremism, John Wycliffe placed some distance between himself and the idea that he was preaching the rural poor should, you know, refuse to serve their lords. He insisted that the preaching of the poor priests had actually been misinterpreted. Quote, "Some men that ben out of charity slander poor priests with this error, that servants or tenants may lawfully withhold rents or services from their lords, when lords ben openly wicked in their ruling," unquote. Yet while he did not openly support rural poor withholding rents or services, he was not afraid to use his powerful theology to support peasants who demanded less oppression from the landlords. Wycliffe once said, quote, "Strifes, contests and debates have been used in our land, for the lords strive with their tenants to bring them in thraldom more than they should be by reason and charity." Also, lords may many times do wrong things to poor men by extortions and unreasonable taxes, and take poor men's goods. And thus lords devour poor men's goods in gluttony and waste and pride, and they perish for mischief and hunger and thirst and cold, and their children also, unquote. Now this condemnation of the abuses by noble lords, coupled with the growing sense of resentment towards the labour laws in the country, created a sense of ambiguity about what John Wycliffe and the poor priests were really all about, and this ambiguity played into the hands of his detractors. It must be stressed that John Wycliffe was fundamentally an Oxford academic whose views were upsetting the status quo of other academics within the church. And in truth, several of these babblers, and the radical babblers, predated him, apparently, an underground populism that had gone hand in hand with rural discontent. The two strands of thought were united mostly in the minds of those who hated John Wycliffe. And because they made the connections in writing, these have inflated the links between Wycliffe and this rural radicalism. It makes John Wycliffe sound like some kind of religious mastermind organising this Christian insurgency across England. That was not the case. But his opinions did play into the hands also of the more militant members of the Babblers. And this is where we encounter a priest called John Ball. The earliest records of John Ball place him in St. Mary's Abbey in York, but at a later date, Ball was to be found in Colchester, and here he had become an incredibly popular priest. His radicalism seemingly predated John Wycliffe, but he was painted as one of Wycliffe's disciples, and one source at the time claimed, quote, "For 20 years or more, this man had been preaching continually in different places, such things as he knew were pleasing to the people, speaking ill of both ecclesiastics and secular lords, and had rather won the goodwill of the common people than merit in the sight of God. For he taught the people that tithes ought not to be paid unless he who should give them were richer than the rector or vicar who received them, and that tithes and offerings ought to be withheld if the parishioner were known to be a man of better life than his curate. He taught, moreover, the perverted doctrines of the perfidious John Wycliffe and the opinions that he held. Being prohibited by the bishops from preaching in churches, he took to speaking in streets and villages and in open fields, nor did he lack hearers amongst the common people, whom he almost strove to entice to his sermons by pleasing words," unquote. John Ball was clearly an incendiary figure, judgmental, fiery, passionate, and popularist. He was repeatedly condemned by his superiors in the church, and often thrown into prison. The Register of the Archbishop of Canterbury contains this decree from 1366 about Ball's preaching, addressed to the Dean of Bocking down in Essex. Quote, It has come to our hearing by common report that one John Ball, pretending to be a priest, is preaching manifold errors and scandals within our said jurisdiction. We order you to forbid any to be present at the preachings of said John, on pain of greater excommunication, and denouncing all who shall offend against it. You shall cite them to appear before us. You shall also cite the said John to appear personally before us, to make answer concerning certain articles and interrogations to be put before him, touching the correction and safety of his soul. The famous medieval French chronicler Foussan went on to say about these events and this man, quote, "A mad priest in the county of Kent, John Ball by name, had for some time been encouraging these notions and had several times been confined in the Archbishop of Canterbury's prison for his absurd teachings. For he was on the habit of Sundays after Mass, when everyone was coming out of church, to collect a crowd around him in the marketplace." Unquote. So what was he preaching? Well, Foussot gives us his version of the words of John Ball, and they are, well, have a listen yourself. Quote, "My friends, the state of England cannot be right until everything is held communally, and until there is no distinction between nobleman and serf, and we are all as one. Why are those whom we call lords masters over us? How have they deserved it? By what right do they have to keep us enslaved? We are all descended of our first parents, Adam and Eve. How then can we say that they are better lords than us, except in making us toil and earn for them to spend? They are dressed in velvet and furs, while we wear only cloth. They have wine and spices and good bread, while we have rye and straw that's been thrown away and water to drink. They have fine houses and manors. We have to brave the wind and rain as we toil in the fields. It is by the sweat of our brows that they maintain their high state. We are called serfs, and we are beaten if we do not perform our tasks. We have no sovereign to appeal to, or to listen to us, or give us justice. Let us go to the king. He is young, and we will show him our miserable slavery. We will tell him it must be changed. When the king sees us, either he will listen to us, or we will help ourselves." Unquote. Now, I will say I am simplifying the full details of the circumstances around John Ball. And in truth, the providence of that speech, let's just add a pinch of salt to it. But you get the gist, and those are incredibly powerful words. The thing you just have to keep in mind is that by 1381, John Ball had seemingly gathered many supporters around him and was a powerful and charismatic demagogue and religious instigator of feelings of ill will towards the current status quo. The historical records of the time do say, just before the outbreak of the Peasants' Revolt, quote, "On being informed, the Archbishop of Canterbury again had John Ball imprisoned for 2 or 3 months. But it would have been better he had locked him up for the rest of his life, or even had him executed. But the Archbishop could not in all conscience put him to death, and so he was released and once more went back to his former errors." Unquote. And it is now because of John Ball that London appears in the narrative again. And one of the contemporary sources claimed that John Ball's words were known of in the city, because a contemporary report claims, quote, "A number of the meaner sort in London came to hear of his words and deeds, and in their envy of the rich began to murmur to one another that the country was badly governed and that all the silver and gold was in the possession of the nobles. These people began to rebel and send word round the neighbouring counties, encouraging those of the same opinion to come at once to London. They would all press the king so hard that there would not be a slave left in England." Unquote. That claim, that account from the time, could be completely true and accurate. But do take on board the bedrock of the London we've been building over the last few episodes. Remember, London split into two political factions. The grocers-dominated stapler faction, mostly rich wool merchants and their allies who were running London to try and restore the Calais staple or wool market and to keep more sensible men in charge of the city. They'd gained control over the city and then lost it to the more populist radical faction led by John de Northampton, who was more focused on giving the workers of London more of a say in how the city was run, because they wanted the traditional franchise of London with all its own protections restored. Northampton had, in his struggles against the rich aldermen, changed the rules of London. Aldermen now had to be elected yearly, along with the supportive Common Council of London, and members of the Common Council were chosen now by the livery companies or the trade guilds of the city, which turned out to be more democratic, as it gave people who weren't rich the chance to have a say in how the city was run. The staplers had retaliated and struck back, and as we covered in quite some detail last chapter, they utterly destroyed John de Northampton's control over the city. In this, de Northampton had not helped himself by siding with John of Gaunt, and in the explosive backlash to this choice, the trade guilds had thrown their support in behind the staplers and their leader, Nicholas Brembe. Mayor Brembe and his successors had clamped down their authority on London, but had failed to materialise any true benefits for the city and its population. The Calais staple did exist, but there were so many exemptions, it made it pointless. The franchise of the city was restored, but then taken away, and rich foreigners were dominating city trade. So that accusation that John Ball's word had triggered resentment towards the rich of England, if Londoners had heard John Ball's words and deeds, they would have had some reasons to support him, but also quite a few not. The accusations that their gold and silver was in the hand of nobles was not true in London. In London, it was in the hands of Italians. And these are the ones people felt angry about. Very few of the common sort would have identified the noble class as being the opposition, unless they were those who hated and feared John of Gaunt. But even then, Londoners' hatred of him was not even over wealth, but political control. He threatened the liberty of London. And indeed, the only group in London who had identified the nobles of England as the enemy could arguably be said to be the stapler faction. It was the nobles in Parliament who were doing these things to London, who were making the decisions that had eroded London's power. If anyone in London would be willing to support John Ball and his anti-noble preachings, one could say his natural allies were perhaps the members of the grocer's company. But that's ridiculous because they are naturally conservative. We don't know. I'm alerting you to this fact because, given the detail we went into last chapter, if anyone in the city had begun to murmur to each other that the city was badly governed and that all the gold and silver was in possession of the nobles, it probably wasn't the working poor of the city. They had reason to kick off anyway. They didn't need John Ball. Whatever the case, someone or something galvanised John Ball. Apparently a bevy of coded messages were sent out across the southeast of England, clearly issuing a call to arms. This ties into something that actually happened a few years earlier in 1377, the Great Rumour, a large confederacy of peasants and peasant leaders supposedly involved in agitation towards the crown, but that didn't trigger a revolt. The secret letters being sent out, or the coded messages being sent out by John Ball, contained code words which apparently could only be understood by Ball's followers. One was supposedly written under a false name and addressed to the men of Essex, and was found conveniently in the pocket of a rioter when he was later being executed. It said, quote, "John Shep, sometime St. Mary's priest of York, now of Colchester, greets well John Nameless, and John the Miller, and John Carter, and bids them that they beware guile in the town, and stand together in God's name, and take with you John Truman and his fellows and more, and look sharp to your own head, and no more," unquote. So, all of this is to say that the conditions were there. There was a low-level, unspoken conspiracy going on between the rural poor. They were angry, they were pissed off, and they had religious backups. and they were talking to each other. So what actually did start the peasants' revolt? Well, the actual cause was the poll tax. The immediate cause of the outbreak of the violence in Kent and Essex was the government's decision to raise some badly needed money by instituting poll taxes. These were levied on every person by the poll, which meant by the head, and were supposedly, well, eventually they ended up being graduated according to rank and wealth. Parliament voted three poll taxes in between 1377 and 1380. This extract from the vote of the third tax of 1380 gives you an idea of how that actually worked out it should be instituted. Quote, first, the Lords and Commons have agreed that, for the aforesaid necessities, there shall be given from every lay person in the realm, male or female, of whatever estate or condition, above the age of 15 years, three groats, save very beggars, who shall not be charged, unquote. So basically, it was a tax on every single person for three groats. Now, by 1380, then worked out a system that richer people did pay a bit more, and poorer people did pay a bit less, but ultimately, everybody paid the poll tax. And Parliament knew it was unpopular. Now, coming on top of all the other grievances, these new taxes aroused deep resentment amongst the peasants of England. Widespread tax evasion clearly took place, so much so that the Royal Council appointed special commissioners in March 1381 to enforce full payment of the tax. The conditions were now just right, and the fire of rebellion began. By the account in a document called the Anonymel Chronicle, the peasants' revolt began just south of Basildon on the 30th of May 1381. That morning, a poll tax commissioner, who was also a justice of the peace and an MP, called Thomas Bampton, summoned the men of three Thamesized villages, Fobbing, Corringham, and Stanford, up to Brentwood in Essex. His summoning was to investigate who from these villages had evaded the poll tax in the previous January. Quote, he had summoned before him the townships of the neighbouring hundred, and wished to have from them new contributions, commanding the people of those townships to make diligent inquiry and to give their answers and pay their due, unquote. In this, Bampton was met by a local landowner called Thomas Baker. Now, he quickly seems to have become the leading representative of the residents. When hearing the demand of Bampton, Thomas Baker, quote, made answer that they would not pay a penny more because they'd already had a receipt from himself for said subsidy, on which the said Thomas Bampton threatened them angrily, and he had with him two sergeant-at-arms of our Lord the King, unquote. The angry residents of Fobbing, however, were supplemented by those of neighbouring Corringdon and Stanford. And because of that, quote, then the people of these three townships came together to a number of 100 or more, and with one assent went to the said Thomas Bampton and roundly gave him answer that they would have no traffic with him, nor give him a penny, on which the said Thomas commanded his sergeant-at-arms to arrest these folks and to put them in prison, unquote. The attempt to arrest Thomas Baker caused the crowd to make, quote, insurrection against him, and would not be arrested, and went to kill the said Thomas and the said sergeants. On this, Thomas fled towards London to the King's Council, unquote. And with that, a countryside insurrection had begun. With the reports of this happening down the river, just north of Tilbury, the advisers of the young king sent Sir Richard Belknap, one of the chief justices of the King's Bench, to restore order. Belknap followed judicial procedure at the time, where he swore in jurors from amongst the local people to make statements about the offenders. But, quote, the commons rose against him and came before him and told him he was a traitor to the king. And they made him give the list of the names of all the jurors. And they took all the jurors they could catch and cut off their heads and cast their houses to the ground, so that the said Sir Robert took his own way home without delay, unquote. Not only was the Royal Chief Justice forced to flee, the massacre of collaborators and those who had aided the poll tax gathering meant the die was properly cast. By the next day, the revolt was rapidly spreading. It was said a local bailiff called John Jeffrey rode between Brentwood and Chelmsford, rallying support for the insurrection. 6 days after it started, on June the 4th, the rebels gathered just north of Braintree, at the village of Bocking, where they debated what they would do in the future. The account goes on to say, quote, "Afterwards the said commons assembled together before Whitsunday, and they went to the manors and townships of those who would not raise with them, and they cast their houses to the ground, or set on fire to them. And at this time they caught 3 clerks of Thomas Bampton, and cut off their heads, and carried their heads about them for several days, stuck on poles, as an example to the others. For it was their purpose to slay all lawyers, and all jurors, and all servants of the king whom they could find," unquote. This Essex rebellion, now numbering a few thousand, spread out. One group began to advise moving towards London almost straight away. Others went south towards Kent, and a large group advanced north into Suffolk. It was led by a former chaplain called John Rory, and in time, this would actually start an entire separate strand of the peasant revolt that's often ignored because of the chaos in London to come. But Rory's forces inflicted great terror on Cambridge, for example, before that part of the revolt was crushed. This was already a savage, violent, neighbour-against-neighbour revolt. It was being fuelled by years of pent-up anger, and it was being focused entirely upon the apparatus of the state, lawyers and legalists, and those who supported them. And it spread through Essex. Another source at the time, the Chironicon Angeli, said, quote, "The peasants, whom we call villains or bondsmen, with the rural inhabitants in Essex, coveting greater things and in hopes of reducing everything into subjugation to themselves, came together in a great multitude and began to make great tumult, demanding their liberty. They intended in future to be bound to pay service to no man. The men of 2 villages, who were the authors and prime movers of this mischief, sent word to each village that, old and young, should flock to them, furnished with such arms as they could get, and that those who did not come or despise this warning would have their goods destroyed and their houses set on fire and their heads cut off. Those terrible threats made all hasten to them, so that in a short time so great a number was assembled that it was estimated at some 5,000 of the meanest common people and peasants," unquote. As always, the precise accuracy of numbers given in any medieval document should be taken with a fistful of salt. But we can say is that the insurrection had begun, there were thousands of people involved, and it was soon spreading all over Essex. Across the Thames, Kent had its own instigating factors for its version of the peasants' revolt. The accounts there say that one of the Knights of the Garter, Sir Simon de Burley, had claimed that a man in Kent called Robert Belling was an escaped serf from one of his estates. Hearing that Belling was hiding out in Gravesend, Burley sent 2 sergeants to reclaim him. This move was seen as unfair, and using local bailiffs as middlemen, Belling had tried to buy his way out of his contract. But this failed. Belling was taken away to be imprisoned in Rochester Castle. This triggered a gathering of furious locals who gathered in Dartford maybe as early as June the 5th, and quickly the crowd turned violent. Now a rebellion, they travelled to Maidstone, where they stormed the prison there and released the prisoners. And then they fell upon Rochester on June the 6th. Quote, "When the men of Kent heard news of what they had long hoped for, they too without delay gathered together a large band of commons and peasants, by the same devices wherewith the Essex men had collected their bands, in a short time stirred up the whole of the county to a similar tumult, and soon they besieged all the roads which pilgrims go to Canterbury, and stopping all the pilgrims, they compared them to swear, first to be faithful to King Richard and the commons, and then that they would be ready to come join them whenever they should be pleased to send for them," unquote. The attacks in Kent upon the jails saw prisoners in the cells released in large numbers, and when the insurrectionists raided the Archbishop of Canterbury's jail in Maidstone, they'd freed John Ball, the radical preacher. Quote, "At last, having been excommunicated, not yet desisting, he was thrown into prison when the commons broke open all the prisons and made the prisoners depart, unquote. With John Ball out, the truth was that in less than 2 weeks, the entire Lower Thames Valley was alight with this rebellion. And then on June the 10th, 11 days after the rebellion started in Essex, the Kentish leaders decided to march on London. Who were leading the rebellion in Kent? Well, John Ball was clearly the spiritual head of the rebellion, but he was joined by two other local leaders, Wat Tyler and Jack Straw. As the great French chronicler Fouissant has it, quote, "On the Monday before the Feast of Corpus Christi, 1381, these men left their homes and set out for London to speak to the king and to gain their freedom, for their object was that no Englishman should remain a serf. At Canterbury, they found John Ball. He was looking in vain for the Archbishop, who is in London with the king, and with him Wat Tyler and Jack Straw. They were given a warm welcome, for the people of Canterbury were on their side. And having decided to make for London to see the king, they sent word to their supporters in Essex and Sussex, as far as Bedford and Stafford, encouraging them to do the same so that London would be surrounded. In this way, the king would be unable to escape them." Unquote. The occupation of Canterbury by the rebels also took place on June the 10th, and it remained a stronghold for the revolt for the next month or so. Quote, "At Canterbury, they invaded the Church of St. Thomas and did great damage. They also wrecked the apartments of the Archbishop." Unquote. Now, the hatred of the Archbishop of Canterbury and his association with the regime really began in Kent more than Essex. It was not found in the Essex mobs, who were mostly focusing on lawyers. Here, it may have been John Ball's own enmity that drove the spark of hatred towards the prelate. We do read, quote, "After the raiding of the monasteries of St. Thomas and St. Vincent, they left for Rochester, accompanied by all the inhabitants of Canterbury, and they were joined by people of the villages right and left to the road, and they advanced like a whirlwind, mercilessly destroying the houses of attorneys and king's proctors and of the officers of the Archbishop's court," unquote. Along with this group, another group attacked Rochester Castle. They terrified the garrison into surrender and took the governor with them. Quote, "At Rochester, they were again welcome, and then went to the castle and seized the governor, Sir John Newton, saying, 'You will have to come with us and be our commander-in-chief, and do exactly as we say.' Sir John tried to refuse, and gave a number of excellent reasons for doing so, but in vain, for they replied, 'Sir John, if you refuse, you're a dead man.' Realising that people are out of their minds and quite ready to kill him, he reluctantly put himself at their head." Unquote. The attack on Rochester Castle saw the freedom for John Belling. And as stated previously, at this point, the forces of Kent were seemingly led by a man, Wat Tyler. We know very little about Wat Tyler, or Walter Tyler, including his name for certainty. Some chronicles suggest he was from Essex, but had served in France as an archer and was a charismatic and capable leader. Some suggest he was a devotee of the teachings of John Ball. Later tales say he was involved because of a lurid story of his brother in Essex having a daughter who was molested by a local noble. All we can say for certain is that we do not know much about Wat Tyler. In fact, all we can say for certain is that Tyler not only seems to have become the principal leader of the Kent Rebellion, but he was responsible for shaping the political aims of the revolt. Another name that appears as a leader is a mysterious figure called Jack Straw. However, that's a name that only appears in a couple of accounts of the events from the time. And consensus between most historians since then is that Jack Straw was a pseudonym, possibly for Wat Tyler, or maybe for the Northern commander John Rory. But again, we don't know. And the general belief is that Wat Tyler and John Ball were the real leaders of this force. Now, not all the rebels left Kent to march to London. Like north of the river in Essex, it was only some of the rebel forces. Many stayed behind to occupy and remain in control of Canterbury, where they were busy searching the city for suspected enemies, dragging their suspects out of their houses and executing them. But there does seem to be a concentrated effort to bring together all the rebels in Essex, Norfolk and Suffolk with the Kent rebels. Ultimately, while many did show up in London, not all could. The rebellion was always bigger than the numbers that turned up in the city. Once the decision was made to march on London, however, the rebels moved at considerable speed. Setting out from Canterbury on the morning of Tuesday the 11th, they reached Dartford by the following day. On the way, they passed a very important person, none other than the widow of Edward the Black Prince and mother of the current king, Princess Joan. The king's mother had been going on a pilgrimage to Canterbury when the outbreak of violence broke out, and upon hearing of what was going on, she had turned right around and her and her party were racing back to London. It is reported that apparently as the rebels passed the king's mother, they made some rather racy jokes and then carried on. On Wednesday the 12th of June, a deputation of the Aldermen of London, together with Bishop Brinton of Rochester, met the rebels of Kent at Blackheath and urged them to disperse. But there was no success. And we do know that on June the 12th, the rebels settled in Blackheath, just southeast of the capital. Quote, "After leaving Rochester, the rebels crossed the river and came to Dartford, never sparing the property of attorneys or proctors as they went. They cut off several heads on the way and soon reached Blackheath, where they encamped on a hill, saying they were for the king and commons of England," unquote. Yet another account, however, showed that this force was not coming alone. A pincer had been unleashed, as in that account it clearly says, quote, "And on the vigil of Corpus Christi Day, the commons of Kent came to Blackheath, 3 leagues from London, to the number of 50,000 to wait for the king. And they displayed 2 banners of St. George and 40 pennons. And the commons of Essex came on the other side of the water to the number of 60,000 to aid them and to have their answer for the king," unquote. Now again, we're not too sure about the numbers, but we are pretty sure the rebels from Kent were assembling at Blackheath and the rebels from Essex had reached Mile End, then a hamlet outside the city walls. London was surrounded, and worse of all, there were no large forces to defend London. The mainstay of the English military leadership was mostly located in Europe right now, leading beleaguered forces in vain against the French. There was a sizable garrison in England at this time, but they were up covering the border with Scotland. As June the 12th wore on, it became clear that this violent rebellion against the officers of the state was now on the doorstep of the city, and London only had its own citizens to defend it. And with that set up, next episode, we'll start telling the story of 3 days in June. Thanks for listening. I'll be back next episode. Hope you enjoyed it. See ya.